As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with Tom Keene and Jonathan Farrow. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Citi's Andrew Hollenhorst expects more hikes this year, says the following: in a time of incredibly elevated uncertainty, we once again see markets as underpricing the level of policy rates this year and have maintained our base case for policy rates. Here's the number, wait for this, 550 to 575, despite an undeniably dovish March FOMC meeting, even with a 25 basis point hike. Andrew Hollenhorst, the man behind the note of Citi, joins us here in New York. Morning, Andrew.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, makes sense of that. 575 on Fed funds in the face of this.
I think it's not hard to make sense of if you follow the inflation data. The big question is, are we going to have a Fed that's focused on financial stability issues or price stability issues? I think that's what we were talking about in the note in terms of the incredible uncertainty, is it looks quite uncertain relative to whether we're going to get this focus on financial stability, which would be more dovish, or this focus on price stability, which would be more hawkish. In the last few days, it looks like things are stabilizing a bit. We're going to get some inflation data later this week. Maybe we start to move the narrative a little bit back towards price stability.
Let's talk about duration mismatches, and not in the bond market and not at banks, just in terms of data and when we're going to find things out. We'll get inflation data on April 12th. I just wonder how long it's going to take to find out the financial stability issues, where on the calendar, and the mismatch this Fed's got to grapple with, because the timeline's going to be all over the place. And if they choose financial instability, they might have to wait and wait and wait and wait. And you think they might have to wait until 2024 before they see the slowdown bite?
It could really take some time before you see the slowdown coming in and affecting growth data, and especially inflation data. If you think about the inflation data over the next 3 months, the next 6 months, it's probably going to come in essentially where it was going to come in before we had the issues in the banking sector. So they could really be waiting to see how this is going to trickle through and flow through the economy. If you go back to where we were just a couple months ago, remember we'd had some months of softer core inflation prints. The Fed was sounding a bit more dovish. Well, then you basically had 1 month of data. You had a strong January and you had some revisions to the prior inflation data, and all of a sudden you had a more hawkish Fed. So we're trying to keep that in mind when we think about the Fed here, that you know the volatility that we saw in two-year yields over the last couple weeks, it makes some sense if you think that they were really moving between these two extremes, where it could be financial stability, that would be more dovish, or it could be price stability. And I think that really does mean that policy rates still need to get above 5.5%.
I love getting your notes. Over the past 2 weeks, I've loved it even more because I feel this exasperation as people basically say, rate cuts, everything is over, and you're just like, stop it, guys, please stop it. Things are still hot. We still have an inflation problem. What kind of feedback do you get every time you put one of these out?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think we actually get a lot of resonance on this idea that inflation is still strong and underlying inflation is still strong. And where there's more of a question from clients is, does the Fed have the ability to respond to that strong inflation? And do they have the willingness to do it? Which is a really important question for the Fed, and I think a question that the Fed should be aware people are asking. Because one of the key things you want to do as a central bank is to provide that confidence that you have resolve to fight against higher inflation. I think the market really got there a month ago or so. We had two-year yields above 5%. Now there are new questions about whether the Fed is going to essentially have to give a little bit on the price stability mandate to focus on the financial stability mandate. That could be problematic if we start to view central banks as unwilling to move against inflation.
How high could 10-year yields go if the Fed does pause, despite hotter than expected CPI, PCE, all of the data indicators that we had been watching before the financial stability questions?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, we've been thinking about interest rates rising because policy rates are rising, but there's this other scenario where policy rates could actually stay lower and you could start to get longer term rates rising. I think Fed officials are feeling pretty confident about that right now, because if you look at longer term expectations of inflation in the market, 5-year forward, 5-year inflation break-evens, well, those have stayed relatively stable, relatively consistent with mandate consistent policy levels. But I think that's what they'll be watching. If that starts gliding up, if you start seeing higher 10-year yields because the Fed is being dovish, that would be a real concern for Fed officials.
We've said a few times they're in the risk management business. May 3rd, they meet, decide. Are they going to have enough information to make the call to hike by the time we get to May 3rd?
I think it's going to be a difficult meeting. I think they will have enough information to continue hiking at that meeting. The question is, what guidance are they giving beyond that? And we saw what happened with the dots at the last meeting a week ago. Those dots that indicate where policy rates should be at the end of the year, I think there's no question they were going to move up at that meeting until you had the issue in the banking sector. So now the question we're asking about May is, well, they don't have to update those dots, but they have to give us some indication of, will there be further rate hikes or will there not be further rate hikes? I don't know that you can do again what central banks did a week or 2 weeks ago. If you remember the ECB hiking by 50 basis points and basically saying, we can't tell you where we go from here. I think in May, at that time, there'll be enough time to view the data, understand what's going on with financial stability, give some guidance. Will there be further rate hikes or will there not be further rate hikes? They'll have to make a decision.
Well, the new line, I think, is additional policy firming.
Additional policy firming, right?
Whatever,
that's a good way to say it, yeah.
Whatever that means. I'm sure they spent a long time coming up with that. Clearly, they believe that what's developed in the banking system is a substitute for rate hikes. And to your point about the dot plot, I think we can probably agree around the table that if we got the dot plot 3 weeks ago, that was going from 5.1 to 560. So let's say they believe the developments of the last couple of weeks are worth about 50 basis points. I've got no idea how much conviction they've got behind that view or whether that really is their view, but I think we can read between the lines. Andrew, how on earth do you make an estimate as to how much the tightening of lending standards may develop off the back of the story of the last couple of weeks and how that equates with a level in Fed funds?
Yeah, I think it's really, really difficult. And I worry a little bit about these statements that the tightening and credit conditions is going to substitute for exactly 25 or exactly 50 basis point of rate hikes. Because you're making an assumption first about how policy rates transmit through to financial conditions broadly, and then how financial conditions broadly transmit through to the real economy. And think about what's happened here. There's all this talk about substituting for rate hikes. Well, we were pricing policy rates to go above 5.5%. We had 2-year yields above 5%. Now we have 2-year yields around 4%, 100 basis points lower. So do we think the tightening of credit conditions substitutes for 100 basis point lower 2-year treasury yield? Because that's what's happened in the market. If we don't, then essentially what markets are pricing is the Fed to fully offset or more than offset the tightening that we've had in credit conditions. And that's really an issue for the Fed if they thought that they had to get policy rates above 5.5% and financial conditions are now loosening. So we have credit conditions tightening, but we have financial conditions loosening. If you saw the housing data yesterday and over the last month, every indicator is turning up now. So we have a bottom in the housing market. It's rising from a bottom. I think that should be another concern where you say, we were trying to slow down this economy. Now the sector that's most responsive to interest rates is starting to reaccelerate.
To your point, given where market pricing is now, how vulnerable is the infrastructure of a market that's been whipsawed again and again and has a lot of fragilities baked in through leverage? How vulnerable is this market to a Fed surprise, a massive Fed surprise that disrupts where things are?
Yeah, I think that's the other real issue for Fed officials now, especially given the new emphasis on financial stability risks. As a central bank, you're always trying to smoothly and incrementally guide policy rates, guide market pricing to what you think is the right level to be consistent with mandate consistent inflation. And the issue for the Fed now is we have this huge disconnect between where the dots are and where the market is. like we were just talking about, if anything, Fed officials maybe wanted to go a bit higher than that. If we start seeing the inflation data come in strong again, and we think we will over the next few months, all of a sudden we could be back in this world where Fed officials think the policy rates need to be much higher. And then can you get there in an incremental and smooth way, or does this become a more violent adjustment? And again, I mean, look at the volatility we saw in two-year yields. I mean, in some ways, that's reflecting the fact that we could very quickly reprice what the Fed is going to do.
They're in a massive bind right now. I think once you get in the business of acknowledging that you think the developments of the last couple of weeks are a substitute for rate hikes, if they get worse, I just wonder how you can keep saying that we're going to get no rate cuts this year. Because if you believe they're a substitute and we're very close to what you've indicated as terminal, then ultimately you should be pulling back if things get worse.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
With us now, I'm pleased to say, is Peter Shipp, the head of macro strategy at Academy Securities. Pete, let's talk about this equity market. The NASDAQ, rip it from a December low at more than 20%. Whaley of BlackRock said earlier on this week that this market believes we're going back to the old playbook. Rate cuts, get along the NASDAQ. She says we're not going back to the old playbook. Pete, what do you say?
I would agree with that. I think the NASDAQ rally is a bit overdone. People are expecting the same sort of performance we saw post-COVID. I think the conditions are just very different. It's not a supporter for that. As a whole, though, I think we want to range trade this equity market, right? As things start getting good, the Fed comes more into play. And as things deteriorate, the Fed comes into play the other direction.
So, Pete, that range at the moment, at least since November, has been 3,800 to 4,200 on the S&P. Is that the range that sticks?
Yeah, I think so. I'm certainly now fading this rally in the S&P. I'm fading it more through the NASDAQ just because I think the outperformance there has been greater. And I don't like the narrative that we return to 2022. The one thing that remains outstanding for me on the banks, and I think this is one thing that's different than the U.S. versus Europe, is people here have alternatives to earning more than 0.2% or whatever a bank deposit is paying, because we've had this gap in rates. And I think people are just becoming aware of that. So that's what I'm watching, to see if we see ongoing deposits leaving the banking system, nothing to do with credit concerns and everything to do with what is a better yield alternative. And that's not the case in Europe yet, because they just started their hiking cycle.
Do you think that this concept of the natural disinflation, the immaculate disinflation, hasn't gone away and is almost embedded right now in what we're seeing, which is that the Fed has an excuse not to hike rates further and to cut rates, and that everything will be just fine and inflation will naturally go away?
You know, I've been in the camp that we are generally headed towards deflation, especially in the goods camp. And we had four or five solid months, right, from September of last year till January of this year, where you saw nothing but deflation. We saw the data bounce a little bit. Right now, you look at inventories, they're creeping higher again. You start looking at shipments and freight, they're going lower. So I think on the good side of things, we're still in an overall deflationary environment. So I think that pulls down. I think housing's pulling down. Healthcare is something to watch. But yes, I think we have overreacted. We have to give this more time. And as these companies are pulling back on their jobs, I think that just filters through. What we've lost sight of, I think, is that there is this long and lag effect, and we're not giving it time. The problem is, as market participants, we don't have that time. We're moving so quickly now, you have to be right ahead of the time.
At what point does the 4% implied Fed funds rate by January of next year ease things enough to reinflate some of those prices that have started to come down?
You know, right now, that's why the one thing I'm betting on is that either they can't hike as much as people are pricing in, but I also do not think that we see massive cuts by the Fed. I think they're going to try and balance this. I think they're going to be very reluctant. I think we had a huge unwind of positions, especially in the 2 years. So some of those data, you know, that data and how we're looking at what's going out further out the curve is just mispriced. So I would not bet against the Fed cutting a lot.
Well, Pete, as you know, spreads this large aren't resolved by a speech. They're resolved by incoming information. So can we keep returning back to something Lisa and I have been talking about over the last couple of weeks? What is the incoming information that will resolve that spread? Is it CPI, payrolls? Is it lending standards? What is it?
You know, I think it's going to be payrolls in particular. That's the one area that we had seen wage inflation tick up. It was coming back down. Jobs have been probably the single strongest thing. When for the last 6 months, at any given time, there are two or three things that you point to that were weak. And one thing that was constantly strong was jobs. So watch out what's happening in jobs. A lot of people are still scratching their head. How can we get these layoffs? And they're not showing up in the jobs number. So that'd be the one area, I think, if jobs continue, the Fed's going to have to hike. If they come back maybe to a little bit of reality, reflect some of the anecdotal evidence, maybe that's what lets the Fed pause.
Do you think the market in the meantime for the next month or so, Pete, is desensitized somewhat to that data point because the focus overwhelmingly is on bank stocks and what's happening in that sector?
You know, I think hopefully we can move away a little bit from bank stocks. I think that's calming. It's all about, do they keep deposits given this yield differential? And now it's time to start thinking about, okay, where's the economy and what reads do we get as we start earnings? And again, it's not going to be about this quarter's earnings. It's going to be what the future outlook is. And I think that's very questionable.
Hey, Pete, this was great. As always, Peter Chir there of Academy Securities. Peter, thank you. Let's get back to the banking system. Joining us now after 2 days of testimony on Capitol Hill from U.S. regulators, Myra Rodriguez Valadares, the principal at MRV Associates. Myra, let's start here. What did you learn over the last couple of days?
Well, I think we really learned that history matters. And this is what happens when we have such a significant decline in history majors, because people forget things. They forget that basic interest rate risk management and liquidity measures are at the heart of being a bank. So there's certainly going to be some changes in terms of supervisory and on-site examination processes, but there's still a lot we don't know. Where is Greg Becker? He needs to be there. He is, at the end of the day, where the buck stops. Where were the board members? We haven't heard from any of them. They're the ones that are supposed to provide oversight. It's not the Fed or the California regulators that run the bank. So we still are missing from the whole range of cast of characters who are really responsible here.
In the meantime, the bill we've heard is $23 billion that the FDIC incurred. It is not taxpayer-funded bailout. It is JP Morgan-funded bailout. How much is there going to be some sort of consequence to the major banks having a special assessment that leaves the FDIC whole?
Right. And I can't imagine that JP Morgan, Citibank, all of the globally systemically important banks in this country are happy about this. They are not the problem. They're very, very liquid. They're very well capitalized. And they certainly don't have concentrations of deposits the way that SVB did. And then the other regional banks are certainly going to take a hit. I don't believe the community banks will. I think there is absolutely no political will on either side of the aisle to hit the community banks. But at the end of the day, it's going to be the American consumer who is going to take a hit, because eventually when premium rise for banks, eventually it gets passed on to depositors. So this is not going to be any kind of free lunch for the regular ordinary American who had nothing to do with SVB's horrible mismanagement.
You talked about history and sort of the lack of history majors. Greg Ipp in the Wall Street Journal wrote this column about how perhaps this isn't the same kind of 2008 financial crisis where it happens all at once, and rather it's a slow-moving crisis of smaller and medium-sized banks losing relevance and losing some of their preeminence in markets. Does that resonate with you?
Unfortunately, it does. I think what we're seeing here is that you're going to have a wide range of investors, journalists, pundits who are now looking, okay, where's the next trouble spot? We have banks that have incredibly large portfolios of souring real estate loans. You also have leveraged companies that have very little in protection for the lenders. So there are some trouble spots there. They've been there all along, but with stock prices going up, investors were happy. The minute that you have a lot of volatility or you have stock prices going down, investors rediscover the religion of good due diligence in terms of credit. So I think we're going to have a lot of dribs and drabs of these kinds of issues. People are now talking about so-called odd accounting rules or unusual accounting rules. No, those have been there all along. So you can move bonds around. You can also make all kinds of changes with non-performing loans and loan loss reserves. So I think every time that investors nitpick a bit more or journalists nitpick a bit more, they're going to find that there are some serious problems that still have not been resolved in the world of bank regulation, supervision, and accounting.
Mary, you know how this works. 1 week later, an equity market rally later, and the questions, the urgency, just kind of dissipates. We've seen that over the last week. Mara, I mentioned this with Lisa a few times. Last week, the big question was, do we need legislative to change right now? What do we need to change? What do we need to do, like, in the next 24 hours? What do we need to change?
I think what we need to change is to make sure that regulators, both statewide and at a federal level, are empowered to do their job. You need to remove heads of banks from being at the district bank, so try to remove those conflicts of interest. And you really need to take this, you need to change the structure. You need to empower both offsite and onsite examiners to do their job. The problem is that when any one of them steps up and tries to tell the truth, right, there's no incentive to do that. And you do need to make sure that those banks that are $100 billion and more are properly regulated and supervised. You do need to do away with the Trump rule, EGRR CPA, that de-designated or changed the definition as to what is a systemically important bank. Because those regional banks, by definition, are very concentrated and they are very important in those regions. And hopefully, this time around, politicians on both sides of the aisle have learned the importance of not watering down those regulations.
That's implied by the very fact that a couple of weekends ago they had to use the systemic risk exception for these banks. Mara, thank you for joining us as always. Mara Rodriguez-Valadares there of MRV Associates.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Pleased to say that joining us around the table here in New York is Steve Pagliuca, Senior Advisor at Bain Capital, founder and CEO of Pax Group Capital Partners and co-owner of the Boston Celtics. And Steve, it doesn't end there, but we haven't got a time.
Enough.
All right, it's good to see you. Brackets for a cause.
Can you just call me Steve, it's fine.
Can we start there, Steve? Brackets for a cause. It's a great tradition here at Bloomberg as well to put this together. March Madness happens every year. I can't follow it, but it's college basketball. And everyone gets very excited. And you've done pretty well this year.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's a great group. And this has probably been the maddest March ever.
So where are you now? How many teams have you got left? Because the last time I tried to do this, I think I was out after the first couple of days. It was like bracket done.
I can't even fill in all the boxes. I mean, it's
who have you got left?
I think I've got one team left.
One team left.
UConn.
And if you come top three, what's your charity?
My charity is the Reform Alliance.
Okay, what do they do, Steve?
They're an organization set up by Bob Kraft and Michael Rubin to basically help prisoners get jobs when they get out of prison. We have a huge prison reform situation in this country. We've got to really help people get out of that cycle, and that's an organization nationally that's been set up to do there. And I have a double bonus this year in that my son actually left his job, and he works for the Reform Alliance, trying to help them.
So they should get some money off the back of this.
I hope so.
Based on
I hope
where
so.
You're going to finish.
You have to go home tonight and say, go UConn. Go UConn.
Go UConn.
If UConn wins, Reform Alliance gets the money.
So go UConn, one. Yeah. Go Celtics, another one. And go Atalanta.
Forza Atalanta.
Forza Atalanta. Where does this end? Are you done now? You've got enough sports teams?
You know, you never know. I'm really enjoying the ones that we have right now, and they're winning. And I'm actually going to go to Milwaukee tonight and see the big game, Celtics playing Milwaukee, the number one versus number two in the East. So that'd be a lot of fun.
You have a life that a lot of people would envy. I'm wondering, there has been a lot of interest in getting into the professional sports game for quite a while. We talked about that during some of the heydays of low interest rates. Have you found that change as it becomes more difficult to access capital for a number of individuals, perhaps not yourself?
Well, it really has changed. I think when we did the Celtics purchase, it was something like $360 million, and the average NBA club is worth $3 to $4 billion now. So it's been a huge increase. But actually, the markets have responded. There are firms that invest in sports franchises specifically, and people put together consortiums to get liquidity.
But do you feel like there is less interest, that people now are sort of focused more on the nuts and bolts of existence rather than, just the sport of it, because there is perhaps other opportunity, but also because they are constrained?
No, I think it's remained the same. It's a highly competitive, fun environment. In Boston, number one sports town in the country, it's just a pleasure. And sports has kind of transcended society, and the teams are really doing a lot of good in the community. NBA Cares, for example, Boston Celtics, United for Social Justice. They're fantastic organizations that go out and help the community. So it's really become intertwined.
Can we discuss exits? You're clearly a fan. How do you think about a potential exit when you have a stake in a sporting organization and you see the appreciation in the overall league? I'm thinking about the Glazers at Man United. I'm thinking about John Henry over at Liverpool. They're clearly looking at these levels and thinking that maybe now is the time to exit. How do you think about that?
Well, our philosophy is family office is just a long-term hold. It's a great asset for a long-term hold. I would hope to go to the grave owning these assets myself. Hopefully quite a while from now, but really long-term hold. I think they're long-term hold opportunities. And now the appreciation has been so much. People that got in early that want to get cash. There's a big market out there of individuals that want to get involved in sports teams, and so they'll be successful doing that. We're seeing very high valuations right now because of the interest in it, and because of the growing television revenues and the whole television landscape changing now as we go from bundling to unbundling back to bundling again, and sports programming is the one solid thing in there. People still will tune in and watch that live. So it's become very valuable to all these digital properties and the networks.
And news as well, Steve. Not just sport. Just throwing that out there. It's sports and
news. And sports. I'm
course,
sorry.
And Bloomberg specifically.
I should have put news first.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for that. Now, that's sport. That's sporting organizations across basketball, football, take your pick. Let's talk about the broader economy right now. If you've got money to put to work at the moment, how easy is it to transact?
There's still plenty of opportunity out there. There's a growing biotech sector in the United States, in Boston, San Francisco. There's still technology companies that are doing well. This period reminds me of coming off of the kind of tech crash in '99. We had a very overvalued situation in tech. And then I remember in those days, I would fly out to California and someone would give me a term sheet and say, you have 2 days to decide. This company's worth $100 million. It has no sales, but it's a great idea to put on the internet. And I was incredulous. I mean, I literally had 17 or 18 of these meetings, and I was disoriented, and we actually I think the only year Bain Capital didn't make a major investment was 1999, thank goodness, and then that all crashed down in April.
But do you feel like we've gotten the washout that eventually you got in 1999, heading into 2000, or do you feel like this still is a tenuous moment where valuations haven't found their floor in any way?
I would say it's still tenuous, and people are going back to the basics, back to fundamentals, looking at cash flow, looking at can the company be profitable. You can't have a 1,000-year time frame anymore when interest rates have gone from next to 0 to 5.5% for a T-bill. Most of my career, I think 3/4 of my career, T-bills were at 4 to 5%, the vast majority of the time. So we really got trapped in this easy money period for the last 10 or 12 years. And now the reckoning has come.
One thing that you're so wonderful about is you've got an incredible view into so many smaller companies and how they're accessing credit. We've been talking a lot about the potential for a restriction in credit really weakening the profile of these companies. Have you seen any evidence of that accelerating, especially over the past couple of months?
It's definitely an issue that, we've invested in about 40 or 50 venture companies in my family office, and many of them need more capital because the banks are with the Silicon Valley situation, they're reining in and making sure these companies have more capital to pay back those loans. So the market's reacting. There is capital out there, but I think that's something to watch for sure.
Steve, we've talked about what to watch, the traditional economic indicators, CPI, payrolls, and whether it's lending standards over the next couple of months. What do you watch every single day? How do you gauge things at the moment?
Well, I actually travel around so much, I try to get out there in the real economy and see what's happening and talk to lots and lots of people. And, we've had this kind of savings build up through COVID, which is a good thing. And when you go in New York, restaurants are crowded. Every flight I'm on is crowded. So I haven't seen, I haven't seen a huge economic slowdown. There's still money out there. There's lots of jobs. There's job offerings. Many of these tech cuts are because the tech companies overspent or with cheap money just went into areas they should have never gone into. So I don't believe those are fundamental, cutting to the core of the tech companies. That's just a restructuring to get back to the basics and get back to where they're really adding value and making money rather than trying to send a man to the moon.
The year of efficiency at Meta.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 70% gain of efficiency.
And still plenty of guys trying to send people to the moon.
Yeah, exactly. There still are a lot of, yes, we talked about that.
Hey, Steve, this was great. Thank you.
Soon you guys will be doing interviews in the moon in 10 years. I'm looking forward to
maybe.
That.
Maybe. I look forward to going up there with you.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Perhaps.
Yeah, what kind
you
of
first,
team
Bramo.
What kind of team
we'll send
they have?
TK first.
They have a little
Tom
Martian
can go
team.
Up for us all, no doubt. Steve Pagliuca of Bain Capital.
Thanks
Steve,
so
thank you, sir.
Let's bring in Doug Kass to talk about this. Seabreeze Partners president. I think it's safe to say friend of the show. Doug, I listen to this show typically when Tom and Paul are anchoring, so I hear on here. I love listening to your take. And you've got one out in your most recent note on the banking situation. What do you think about the turmoil, some would say crisis, that we've experienced? Is it behind us?
Sure. First of all, good morning. And hey, Bramo, first time, long time.
Hey, good morning.
There's an English expression. I always try to come out, Matt, and, provide some differentiated viewpoints, not the regular memorized bullet points of the permas and the bulls and the perma bears. Anyway, there is an English expression that is claimed to be a translation of a traditional Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. And I think it's an apt description of the market and the current business events over the last couple of weeks. I guess based upon the news over the last month, we have to relearn some old lessons from all this.
What are the lessons?
Good question. First, when a government official says a problem has been contained, pay no attention. Second, government and policymakers are the ultimate short-term oriented players. They simply can't withstand much pain in the economy or in the financial markets. So bailouts and rescues always follow. And I think finally, almost no one will accept responsibility for his or her role in precipitating a crisis. Not the leveraged speculators, not the willfully blind leaders of our banks and financial institutions, and certainly not our regulators, our government officials, members of the Fed, rating agencies, or politicians. And I think if we look, getting back to Max's question, the banking crisis was seemingly the outgrowth of poor and aggressive individual bank managements. Banking supervisory failures coupled with monetary policy that was pitted against the industry, at first taking rates too low, which had a painful impact on the net interest income and margins, and then on a time with unprecedented climb in interest rates. Rates rose to levels that disintermediated and exposed banks with large wholesale deposit bases. So I think that this crisis will exaggerate disinflationary impulses and has probably signaled an end to the tightening cycle by slowing the expansion and transmission of credit. But the S&P to us is now trading at the higher end of our projected trading range, and markets are likely poised to again get burned for not believing the Fed. Well, I don't think sustained rate cuts are highly likely until at least 2024. And I agree with your assessment of the economy, Bramo.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. But
he's
curious.
On board with the gloom.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hold on a second. It's not gloom as much as trying to be nuanced and understanding the dissonances in the market. And right now, one of the dissonances that you highlighted, Doug, was that people are pricing in significant rate cuts by the end of the year. They've retraced a bunch of that, and I think that we should reflect that. This morning, we have seen a repricing back upward in terms of Fed funds rates later this year and even earlier next. Mild, but still. How much will that really be not the death knell, but really a spike in the heart of this rally of equities when there is a realization that, yes, perhaps there will be a pause from the Fed, but not wholesale rate cuts?
That's an important factor, but there are two. I think what contributed to this rally in part was what you described, the decline in rates, but also a rare thing. Mostly market positioning doesn't matter, Lisa, but to us it has mattered a lot recently. As an example, if you look at the American Association of Individual Investors, the bullish reading is in the bottom 2 percentile. And without exception, my hedge fund friends are of a saturnine temperament and are defensively positioned. And the second thing I wanted to mention is, I think that we all have a lot of respect for my old pal, Bob Farrell. And his famous quote is that the breadth of market is important, that broad-based rallies have the potential to continue while narrowing rallies are prone to failure. And I was reading some interesting research from Susquehanna yesterday. As of yesterday, the combination of Apple, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Meta, Tesla, Amazon, Google, and Salesforce have contributed to over 160% of the S&P gains for the year. So that means that the S&P would be negative without these stocks. That's a really important factoid. And if you look at just Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Meta, and Google, they're up 19% year-to-date. The S&P is up 4%, which means that the remainder of the 495 S&P companies are down on the year.
And buy the dip has been a very successful strategy this year. Do you buy those? Do you feel like the baby has been thrown out with the bathwater, at least when you look at banks and financials?
We have been buying the dip. I had a non-consensus view that we'd have a good first half when the consensus or group stink was looking for a down first half, if you remember,
yes,
as the year started, and that but the second half would be challenging and that we'd end up basically with a flat year. And I continue to see basically the market in a chop bucket from 3,700 to 4,100. We're around 4,055 right now. So obviously there's 50, I don't mean to be precise, but there's 50 to 100 S&P points of upside, but probably 325 to 350 a downside. We moved to a market neutral position this morning, and if the market continues to expand higher, we'll likely move into a net short position.
We've been talking about a divergence that seems to be growing between the smaller, the regional banks and the larger banks for profitability, not just with respect to the potential for collapsing.
Sure.
Do you believe in that? Do you think that there needs to be a greater differential and a greater risk premium placed on some of the regional banks just by virtue of the deposit beta and the concerns that will end up being higher costs?
I think it's quite obvious that the small to medium-sized banks are disadvantaged right now and will be for an extended period of time. Oddly enough, I think the large money center banks in this banking crisis, which we have been accumulating aggressively, may even represent a generational opportunity, and I know that's a very differentiated view. But if you think about it, you look at J.P. Morgan, Wells, Bank of America. The industry, the large cap banks, have reduced their leverage by half from the great financial crisis. The liquidity has more than doubled. There's no subprime. Credit books have been generally de-risked, notwithstanding the CRE issue. And what is never mentioned is the humongous technology investments that J.P. Morgan has spent upwards of $10 billion a year behind them. And that again, advantages, back to your point, the large money center banks from their competition, especially the smaller ones, but also the non-bank entities. And then they all passed the quite extreme stress tests. I mean, assuming those stress tests assumed a third lower value of commercial real estate, a halving of the stock market, et cetera.
And the regional banks don't have to, or the smallest.
I think it's also ironic. No one has ever mentioned that the bank stress tests never tested an increase or spike in interest rates, proving once again they're a bunch of feckless scoundrels.
It's nothing to do or not directly related to trading intelligence, but maybe more political or even social. I want to get your take on the 2018 rollback of the Dodd-Frank bill, because a lot of people have said that has been part of the problem here in terms of, you know, less regulation. On the other hand, Barney Frank himself, co-author of the bill and board member at Signature, came on this show and said he doesn't think that had anything to do with it. He doesn't think that regulation needs to be beefed up at all. What's your take, Doug?
I couldn't disagree with him more.
But what's the deal? He wrote Dodd-Frank, and then he goes out and says we don't need regulation.
The funniest thing is, I don't even know if you guys remember what a Naderator was, but anyway, I was a Naderator with Ralph Nader, and I wrote a book called Citibank while I was a second-year student getting my MBA award, and then we talked about the regulatory issues facing and mismatching of assets and liabilities that would end up with a crisis. We were only about 45 years too early. But the regulatory pullbacks, I think it was in 2018 by the former president, were profoundly important and influential in creating the crisis that we have today. But I do think, Matt, that it was the supervisory functions that really failed.
Yeah, and that's going to be one big question as we examine the potential report that I think is coming out next month.
Nobody dropped the hammer.
Yeah, well,
as
exactly.
One senator put it. It's just the rules were there. Everyone was talking about it, and no one did anything about it.
An enforcement issue, perhaps, rather than an oversight issue. Doug Kass, thank you so much for being with us. Seabreeze Partners President joining us on the phone.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.